Hello, and welcome to the RAF Museum Research Podcast. Today I'm talking to Air Commodore Andrew Curtis, and his career highlights could form the better part of a conversation in their own right. But amongst these, and Andy will introduce himself more fully in a moment, he served in the Joint HQ during the First Gulf War, completed two operation tours in Afghanistan, served as the Assistant Head of Defence Logistics, and most recently as Programme Director for the Defence Support Network Transformation Programme. And he's been published in the Journal of the Royal United Service Institute, and is currently completing a part-time PhD. Andy and I are going to discuss the research for this PhD thesis on the translation of strategy and military capability. Andy's research examines the methods used by the Ministry of Defence, the MOD, and the armed forces over the last 70 years to reach decisions over what military capability to invest in and why. In doing so, Andy hopes to establish what factors have shaped decision-making, determine why these factors have the effect they do, and suggest ways of mitigating the negative effects. Both strategy and military capability can be difficult concepts to define in a succinct and meaningful way. So I'm going to partly sidestep this and throw Andy under the bus and interrogate him on how to use each term during relevant parts of our conversation. Here I will just say it may be useful at the outset for our listeners to think of strategy very broadly as the plan of action designated to achieve long-term or overarching objectives. For military capability, it might succinctly be defined as the ability to achieve a specified military objective or exert a desired effect within specific operational environments. As such, it goes beyond numbers of troops and platforms. But for those who have stayed with us, Andy, can you introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure. Andy Curtis. So I've just left the Royal Air Force after a career of almost 35 years, which has been a wonderful career. It's given me opportunities to see the world, to advance as a professional logistician. And when you consider that when I joined back in the mid-80s, we were still in the middle of the Cold War, the changes that the service has been through between then and now, and to be part of that journey and to be now part of a force that is far more professional and applies far more rigor to the delivery of air power than it did 35 years ago was really exciting.
And for our listeners as well, I should explain that today we're underneath the Education Centre in the RAF Museum. So if you hear the pitter-patter of little feet or the exciting sound of music and small children, that is the reason why. From having read the sort of bio of your thesis, the underlying justification for your research would appear to establish how the UK can effectively produce the military capabilities it needs to achieve its strategic aims. Is that the main benefit as you see it?
Yes. So again, going back to my time in the service, as a junior officer, you don't question the equipment that you had to do the task. But actually, over time, you start to consider, why am I using this? Whether it's something fairly small or minor, or whether it is a complete weapon system. Why is it that the Air Force is employing Lightning, Phantom, Buccaneer? Why are we actually using these weapon systems to deliver the effect that we are seeking to achieve? And so that in itself sparked an interest, but actually probably what was even more relevant was then doing jobs in the main staff appointments that focused on that type of activity. So procurement, acquisition, working with industry to secure the next generation of combat air, for example. And then to understand how that process worked, what were the underlying factors that drove that decision making? Indeed, were there any underlying factors? Because it was difficult to see from start to finish why we were doing some of the things that we were doing. And that probably is what got me started on the idea behind the thesis. We seem to be doing a lot of activity, a lot of capability planning, a lot of force generation work. But was it all joined up, and was it actually delivering what it was that the services were there to do?
These are really important questions. So I'm really pleased we're sitting down to try and get some of the principles out. But before we get into the sort of meat of our conversation, I think it is definitely worth talking about the methodology you've been using. So I found it quite interesting that while studying military capability and strategy, two subjects prone to abstract concepts at times, you found your way into grounded theory where, when used in the classic sense, this is an approach predicated on abstract conceptualization. Is this how and indeed why you're using grounded theory, i.e. to produce a conceptually integrated theory, or are you using it more as a conceptual description approach within a more general methodology?
So it's more the latter. I think it's worth pointing out at the start that the grounded theory approach was very much focused on tackling the outputs of the elite interviews. And the element that sort of caught my eye was constructivist grounded theory. And in really simple terms, what that does is it recognizes the researcher. So it recognizes, in a qualitative approach to research, the activities of the researcher are quite key. And so, for example, in an interview, in fact, in this podcast, is a really good example. Your role in this, I wouldn't be talking about what I'm talking about now if you hadn't asked me the question. What we talk about next will be driven by where you take the interview. And so the constructivist approach to grounded theory recognizes that actually it's not cut and dry. It's not like a scientific experiment in a laboratory where you do the same thing, and the very fact that you happen to be there in a white coat doing the work is almost immaterial, because the experiment that you are undertaking under the laboratory conditions is going to happen whether I'm in the white coat or whether you're in the white coat. That's not true in qualitative analysis. So it recognizes that, and recognizes the experiences and the knowledge of the researcher. That was key for me, because there is a danger in going after a research subject that is very close to either something that you've worked on for a long time, or something that you have a lot of knowledge about or are very passionate about, because your research becomes influenced by your experiences. And so from the outset, I knew that was going to be the case. So whilst I didn't have a hypothesis around the factors relating to the translation of strategic direction into military capability, I had worked in jobs that did exactly that. So I had background knowledge, I had baggage. And being able to recognize that and allow for it as part of the methodology was really important.
I think that's a very good point in terms of the questions I'm planning to ask you. My role is very much to be the idiot in the room. One that I take naturally to, you mentioned the assumptions you might make based on your past experience and the need to build those in, and also draw strength and recognize weakness from them. That's one of the things which I think will be interesting to come onto in military capability, because assumptions often seem to be baked in when we're trying to translate strategy into military capability. But I think, first of all, if we touch on strategy, what is it we are really meaning when we're talking about strategy here?
Yeah, so strategy is a great word. And if you ask 10 people about strategy, you get a dozen answers. So a good way of trying to understand strategy, there's a really famous quote by Eisenhower, that, you know, the plan is nothing, planning is everything. And lots of people use that. What they don't realize is he actually then went on to say the reason for planning, I think the words he used were, to become steeped in the problem that one day you might have to solve. And that's the important bit, I think, about that quote. So the reason that you do planning is that you know there's a problem out there that you need to solve, and you are understanding it, and you are getting to a position where either you're then going to go ahead and do it, or there is something on the shelf ready as a contingency when you need it. It's the same thing with strategy. Strategy is not about writing something down. It's about doing something. It is something that is ongoing, and it's something that is reactionary, because the parties who are involved have a vote, are doing things that change the environment. The other problem with strategy is everybody uses the word now. And if you actually look in the dictionary, the first definition of the word strategy in the dictionary is about planning in the general sense. The military element of it is now the second definition. So the word has been stolen. That's a real problem, because you then end up with different people meaning different things when they use the word. And that is another issue. Colin Gray, when he wrote about strategy, said one of the biggest problems with strategy is we don't know what we're talking about because we're all coming at it from a different angle. So that's the first problem, and it is a big problem. One of the other problems is that you've got different levels of strategy, and we call them all strategy. So we as a nation now like the term national strategy, which 50 years ago would have been grand strategy, where the thesis is focusing on is actually at the military level, taking the strategic direction, national strategy, then considering the activities of those senior officers, senior civil servants at the top of defence, and what they are doing with that strategic direction. But ultimately, it's all about picking the direction from the national strategy. That's the start point of what we're interested in the thesis.
I should just add here that we've decamped to a different room, hopefully quieter. The children weren't the problem for our listeners, it was the teacher. But we do, as I was saying, get to use the word hullabaloo to describe the reasoning for why we had to move. I see part of the problem in terms of translating strategy into military capability is that it's often perceived as a one-way direction of travel for strategy in terms of how it's formed. The military is given a direction and it then implements its own strategy and how to achieve that, and then the forces below it achieve their own. But there is a sort of two-way conversation about how sort of national strategy should be formed and then the strategy levels below that.
Yeah, absolutely. So the key thing is that it is iterative. You don't just do it once, and everybody should be playing. And you're right, a real mistake is to, for example, look at the national security strategy, the document, and say, okay, well, I've done the strategy. There it is. You know, read that, job done. Actually, that's probably the biggest mistake you can make. That, at best, is no more than the start point. And we're back to the strategizing piece. It should be guiding your actions and your decisions. And I think you're right. A lot of people just completely overlook it. It's almost like that's one thing off my to-do list. The government has done strategy for the next 5 years. What are we going to do tomorrow? And that's part of the problem, is that a lot of people absolutely think it that way, and now start worrying about the tactical issues, the things that are in the press, the things that are going to not get the government re-elected, whatever it happens to be. And so as a result, you don't keep coming back to the issues that are driving your decision-making, because you're sidetracked, the government is sidetracked by the here and now. And all of those things are factors in the translation of strategic direction to military capability, is the fact that we do strategy very badly.
I'm going to move on to our general conversation to explore that. Really, before we do that, we also need to define military capability. At its basic level, can you provide a definition? Because previously, material factors such as numbers or platforms, and indeed delivering military capabilities, has often been very platform-centric. So can you give us a sort of idea of what we really mean about military capability here?
Yeah, I think it's worth just banging that nail out of sight. It was all about equipment. It was all about numbers. And a very good reason for that, because all the way through the Cold War, it was all about deterrence. And you generate a deterrent by having equipment and by displaying the wherewithal to use it. So there's nothing wrong with that, but it was of its time. And what defence does now is it considers capability, so that's all of the factors that go together to deliver a specific military effect.
And defence uses what are called defence lines of development, or DLODs. And those are all the things that when you add them up, they give you a capability. And sure, they include things like equipment. They include people, but they also include training, doctrine, infrastructure. And so the idea now is that rather than focusing on buying a shiny new piece of equipment, we turn around and we say, actually, what is the effect that we want to achieve? And therefore, what is it that we've got to do in addition to just buying 12 aeroplanes or however many aeroplanes? So the idea about thinking about military capability, if you want just one thing, it's joining everything up to deliver that military effect. Make sure that you think about them all, you resource them all, and you sequence that resourcing. We should be making decisions about purchasing what we need to deliver that capability in a sequential manner. If I know that the training system is not going to deliver me 12 combat-ready pilots until 2022, that in itself should be driving investment decisions elsewhere in that capability. Therefore, do I need to spend £100 million this year on this set of spares because I'm not actually going to be using that capability until 2022 in this example? Therefore, big defence can use that £100 million to do something else with. And if you think about it in that way, not only do you deliver that capability, but you're also then actually managing the big picture in a much more coherent way.
But it's interesting as well that you mention, within the context of that example, combat-ready pilots, because of course what we define as combat-ready must also come from how we're translating strategy into capabilities.
Absolutely. All you have to do is look back at recent history and what defence has been asked to do. So there were a lot of people 10, 15 years ago suggesting that all the military would do in the future would be counterinsurgency operations. Well, all you've got to do now is look at the resurgent Russia, and suddenly peer-on-peer activity is very much, you know, back on the horizon. And in fact, not even on the horizon, it's now quite close. So if you look at that from an air power perspective, what did the Air Force do in support of counterinsurgency operations? Close air support. And because we had control of the sky, we effectively had air supremacy, we could do that at 10,000 feet, keeping our aircraft safe, but delivering the effect that we wanted. If you are in a heavily contested airspace against a peer adversary, and you want to fly at 10,000 feet, dropping precision guided munitions, you'll last 30 seconds. Back in the Cold War, all the training was done below 250 feet. Although we are now a far more professional service and we have far more experience of prosecuting operations, that is still in quite a narrow band when you consider the totality of all of the things that air power is expected to do. And so there is an element of spread betting, because you're never going to be in a position to do everything. Of course, that then brings you back to your strategy and understanding the world and working out what spread betting you need to do. And that in itself is then influencing your military capability, because once you've worked out what you think the world is going to look like, you're then taking the next step and saying, what does that mean for my military capability? I need to be able to do X, Y, and Z. Right, now let's look at all the defence lines of development. What do I have to do within those defence lines of development to be able to do X, Y, and Z, to be able to meet the strategy in front?
This is a nice point to dive into the main substance of what your research has been about, looking backwards at previous examples of how strategy has been attempted to be translated into capabilities. Within that, there are obviously going to be some challenges which you have identified. And I think bureaucracy is one which you've highlighted before. Systems which constrain innovative thinking, they're risk averse.
Yeah, so you're right. Any big organisation is underpinned by an element of bureaucracy. It's inevitable because one person can't make all the decisions. But part of that bureaucracy can be problematic when it comes to how you turn that strategic direction into military capability. Because it is, we said, it's dynamic, it's iterative, and therefore expecting just to step through a standard process and get the right result is not always going to give you the desired effect. In fact, it probably seldom will. The problem with the bureaucratic approach was quite an early idea that if you go back through a number of defence reviews, you can see that problem starting to show. But if you speak to a number of people now, the general view is actually that bureaucratic support is not the constraining factor that it once was. I'm not sure that you can actually point to any one thing that has improved. And so, interestingly, part of the problem set during the Cold War, the analysis from the interviews that I've done would suggest that that's less of a problem.
That's really interesting. I think we might want to come on and try and think about what has changed. I think if we start by saying the sort of people you've been interviewing, that would be quite useful to get into so we know the context in which this research is happening.
So I've been very fortunate in that as a result of a long career in the service, most of the people at the top of defence, and I'm talking from the chief of the defence staff down, I know to a reasonable extent. As a logistician in the post-Cold War environment, you live in a joint world. As a young junior officer, everything was light blue oriented. After the Berlin Wall came down and we got into expeditionary operations, but we became a lot smaller, suddenly a lot of the enabling capabilities the single services couldn't do anymore. Defence logistics is now inherently joint. You work in a joint environment, so the people that I know and that I've worked with, just as many of them are from the Army or the Royal Navy as they are from the Royal Air Force. And so that's key. And of the 30 plus interviews that I carried out, I think 13 of those either were at the time or have since become four-star admirals, generals, air marshals, or civil servants. And so once you've got that level of support, then when you approach people who are subordinate to them, clearly senior to me, and say, those people have already given me their time, everybody says yes. And there's also an element of every senior officer loves the sound of his own voice. I was a senior officer when I left the Royal Air Force, and I love the sound of my own voice. And so a lot of people are very keen to give you their view, to give you their thoughts and ideas. What you've then got to do is to make sure that when you come to run the interview, actually you get them to tell you what you want rather than they either want to tell you or in some cases think that what you want to hear. It was a lot easier to get the interviewees than I thought it was going to be. It was actually a lot harder to get the Ministry of Defence's Research Ethics Committee to give me permission to speak to these people than it was to get them to agree to speak to me.
It's very interesting that having got this corpus of elite interviews, how you've then extracted the data using grand theory, which we've discussed, and the sort of concepts which emerged.
So it was very interesting to see, because actually what I wanted from the interviewees was their own experience. I wanted their lived experience of the current situation, the 2010 Defence Review, living through the Labour government and all the decisions it made in the first decade of the 21st century, perhaps going back as far as the Strategic Defence Review of 1998. But I didn't want them to go back any further. I didn't want, for example, to be talking to a four-star admiral about Duncan Sands' Defence Review in 1957, because all he knows about that is what he's read. I want his knowledge and experience of what he's doing now. So you had to be a little bit careful to make sure you achieve that. But we got to a point, having completed the interviews and having then stepped through the first element of grounded theory, open coding, and coming up with hundreds and hundreds of separate data points that then coalesced around a number of big issues. The first one was past defense reviews. What we have done over the last 50 years has an impact on what we're doing now and what we're going to do into the future, both in terms of how we think, but also the decisions that we've made. So path dependency is an interesting idea, but there's no doubt that when you have got capability with a shelf life measured in decades, that decisions that you made 10 or 20 years ago are absolutely going to be front and center in what you're doing today. So path defense reviews and the decision and the whole path dependency thing, really quite significant. The strategic context, if you like, the here and now, surprising thing that I saw when I looked at the defense review that was done straight after the end of the Cold War. It's called Options for Change, 1991. And if you read the foreword by the Secretary of State and his sort of call to arms was about how we're going to have smaller but more efficient, better trained people. And stuck in there was the phrase, better housed. How did that get in there? Well, it got in there because in the previous 6 to 12 months, there had been a massive media campaign on how atrocious service marine quarters were. And it took a lot of government bandwidth to solve. And as a result, it was that important that it got into, if you like, the strap line for the biggest change of military capability, i.e. what are we going to do now that the Berlin Wall has come down and we've won the Cold War, made it in there because of what was happening there and then. Amazing. I would never have believed it, but that is significant. So you've got those two. You've then got what I sort of blobbed up as sort of politics and politicians. And whilst there's a strong argument which I support that says the general approach to the UK's national grand strategy, foreign policy, hasn't really changed much, whether you've had a Conservative or a Labour government since the end of the Second World War. Actually, when you drop it down a level, politics makes a big difference. Not quite the same as in the United States, where you've got big questions around bases, you know, in states and senators and congressmen have a real influence. Not quite as bad as that, but nevertheless significant. Politicians themselves, how they are, what their experience is, absolutely plays into it. The next one that came up, affordability, and there are two real different schools of thought here. One is that money, resource, finance, budget absolutely drives a defence review. And the other one, unsurprisingly, is that it doesn't. It's government decision-making. If the government wants to spend 5% of GDP on defence, it can. It might not feel that it's able to, given the economic situation, the expectations of the people, what it put in its manifesto, all of those things. But ultimately, it can if it wants to. Might not get re-elected. But ultimately, the amount of money either that you are given up front or that you negotiate during the process as part of what we today call a comprehensive spending review absolutely plays into it. Coming to the end, there's two more. The next one is how defence is organised. How it goes through its procurement cycle, what process it uses, how it manages its equipment and service. Most of those things, it is master of its own destiny. It can decide how it wants to do that. The way it does it is really a considerable driver. Now, the most recent change that defence made was after the 2010 defence review, and we had what was called the Levine reforms that made quite a significant change to the way that defence manages capability. Basically, what it did is it decentralised that decision making, and the budgets have gone down to the single services, and they now do. So at the macro level, defence was directed, that's how you're going to do it. But that still leaves a massive amount of wriggle room in how you are actually going to do it. One of the three stars I spoke to gave quite a good analogy in terms of where, you know, how much direction do you get. So what he said was, if I told you to stop people crossing that road, how would you do it? So you might put up a barbed wire fence, you might shout and scream a lot, you might
shoot them all.
Yeah. But you can decide. So stop people crossing the road. But I'm not advocating shooting people, by the way. Not in that instance. Traffic lights would probably do. But again, a good example. So an awful lot of latitude, and all of the other things that I've mentioned, the strategic context, politicians, what's gone on in the past, affordability. When you get to the senior military level, and bearing in mind this is where I'm coming from, I'm trying to understand what the people at the top of defence are doing to get that translation. All of those things before are almost done to them. They're really shaping the translation. The people in defence can't really do anything about those things. But they're there, and they're influencing the outcome. But running the defence enterprise, they can absolutely do everything about that. That's determining the translation. And then the final one, and I've deliberately left this one until last, because I'm sure it will lead into the next session, are the single services themselves. So we've got a Navy, we've got an Army, we've got an Air Force. So why is that? Well, because we've always had an Army and a Navy, and 100 years ago, we thought it was a good idea to create an Air Force. I'm being really flippant. But that's where we are. Those services are incredibly powerful organisations. Because guess what? Every single serviceman that sits within the Ministry of Defence is either from the Army, the Navy, or the Air Force. And those services train that individual, developed him, educated him. They're going to promote him or her. And so the influence that the services can have in that situation is huge. And the services are professions. Professions exist to make sure that they continue to exist. So if you want advice on the employment of air power, and you're the government, you go to the Royal Air Force. Because that's the only professional organisation that does that. Nobody else does. Okay, you can talk to an academic, but he's never actually done it. You could talk to somebody like me, who used to be in the Air Force. But actually, I used to be in the Air Force. So all of those things that I've talked about, all of that baggage is there. And that is really significant, because an element of what the service is doing is making sure the service continues to survive. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm saying it is the thing. And so that in itself has a significant influence. So at the next level up of thinking about all of the things that the people have said, what categories, to use the grounded theory terminology, the ones that I've just outlined are what I think are the influencing factors in that actual process.
The last point, I definitely agree with. Forces do act as their own pressure groups. I think that is almost inevitable, and I don't think that will surprise anyone who's listening that that's how it works. It's an interesting idea that were we to start thinking about how's the best way of delivering military capability today, if we were to start from scratch, is this the system we'd end up with? And that's perhaps something we could talk about later. But the factors you've outlined there, which emerge from the interviews, again, it comes back to that two-way process about strategy, as does the pressure group point.
a lot of those points do in fact feed into strategy themselves. One can argue that the funding which is made available is part of the strategy. And so I suppose for all of this, it comes down to how is it we're really thinking about achieving military capabilities? Do we start with an idea of what is it that we need? Or is there this thought of what is it that we, this is very Jerome K. Jerome in a way, where they, you know, what do we need? And they fill the boat up five times over and one of them comes up with, you know, what can we not live without? Or is it we sit there and go, what is the influence we want to have in the world, the grand strategy element of it, and then plan around how can we best make that happen?
So you make a really good point. If we were starting from scratch, would we do it this way? No. That's probably true in almost any walk of life. I can certainly think of situations I've had in my last 50 years where, you know, I wouldn't do it that way again. So there's this wonderful or horrible expression, you know, you are where you are. And that is very true in this situation. And in fact, one of the senior officers that I interviewed, very experienced in capability management, and his line was, the force in being is the dominant thing when you start looking at your decision-making space. I might want to invest a quarter of the defense budget in cyber, but how am I going to do that from where I am now? So first off, what am I not going to do? The military is terrible at stopping doing stuff. If you want to do more stuff, we always want more resource. And so actually being better at not doing stuff would be a good thing. But to make a big decision like that, so, okay, I'm going to spend 25% of the defense budget on cyber. I'm clearly expanding simply for the effect. So I'm not into fighting set piece armored battle anymore. I'm going to get out of heavy armor. That's the sort of level that you would have to go to make such a significant change. Okay, so I'm now starting to generate sufficient headroom in my budget to be able to say, I've now got some money I can throw at cyber. But what am I going to do? What am I going to do with all that kit? All right, well, tank. I'll just stop using it. You know, it's sat in a storage facility at the moment. Well, you know, I'll sell it or I'll just leave it there. What about all the people? What about all the infrastructure? What about all the tactics? What about all the training? So I've now got a bunch of soldiers who I trained to drive tanks. Are they all going to be able to do this cyber stuff? Probably not. So what am I going to do with them? Oh, I'm just going to make them all redundant and start again. I mean, those are some really fundamental questions. If you want to make a big change of direction, you've got to confront those. And so the second point that this very smart three-star said was, you've also got to recognise that to make that sort of decision is a big thing for government. And it's not going to be easy because what am I talking about? I'm talking about doing away with regiments and traditions, and, you know, the old boys' brigade are coming out now, and can we possibly not have any tanks anymore? Government's not up for that. You know, there is always something more important than worrying about a fundamental review of defence. So generally speaking, those big decisions, governments are not up for. So you end up just making small changes. Just subtly shifting what you used to do. And a lot of people argue, interviewees included, that the fundamental change that we should be making is around being able to regenerate. It's around, you know, getting it least wrong. And so you could make an argument that whilst we are doing things differently to how we're doing in the Cold War, ultimately, the big approach of what people in the army call fight tonight is still dominating our way of thinking. And there's a strong argument that says, actually, maybe it doesn't need to anymore.
I think the idea that there are costs, not just financial, but in terms of particularly political costs.
Yeah, societal costs.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think a really easy way of understanding that is we've just bought a load of F-35s. If we were to scrap them straight away because for some reason we decided they don't fit the future direction of strategy and it's more cost effective just to bin them. The political cost of that decision would be enormous. And so it's far more likely that you have this sort of built-in inertia being maintained and really only being able to nibble around the sides to make small tweaks. I think one of the things we haven't talked about, except for just now, the societal impacts, which will feed a little bit into capabilities perhaps, is we now have a very different society to the one we had 50 years ago, particularly around casualty aversion. And what we would consider heavy casualties today is not what we would have considered heavy casualties in the past. And that comes into a sort of threat-based aspect of our forces, I suppose. That's one of the threats we have to counter. We can't afford to have high losses. So that's something which comes into capability translation.
So that's an interesting point. The whole how the military fits in with the people. But interestingly, again, another interviewee, another reason why we don't get rid of tanks, ships and planes is because that's what the public sees and expects and wants to a certain case. So to argue against taking every main battle tank out of the army's inventory, to make that argument, you know, you're pushing an open door when you're trying to get the public on side, because army equals tanks. The casualty one is quite interesting as well, because I would argue that actually during Iraq and Afghanistan, that the country as a whole recognized the casualties in those conflicts. It was very concerned about whether or not some of those casualties, some of the deaths and some of the injuries could have been averted because we got the wrong capability, you know, the body armor stories, the snatched Land Rover stories, etc. But the fact that we had made a decision to put the military in harm's way and they'd got harmed, I think that the nation as a whole accepted that. And whilst you're right, the scale is nothing like what it used to be, but then the size of the if you like the manpower footprint is far less than it was for conflicts in, you know, certainly in the two world wars. What it does drive though is decision making around capability. So all you've got to do is look at the advances that were made in medical care, the amount of money that we threw at counter-IED, the roadside bomb threat in Afghanistan. And again, don't get me wrong, I'm not for a minute suggesting we shouldn't have spent every single penny that we spent, but every penny that we were spending on increased medical cover and counter-IED was money that we weren't spending on other military capabilities, ships, planes and tanks.
Fascinating about the idea of casualties and the idea that perhaps it's when capabilities are wrong and they're unnecessarily taken, which is the real driver there. But I think one of the keys things which comes out of that was two, and that's, first of all, that effects don't necessarily have to be military. That's part of the definition we had at the beginning, that they can be specific effects designed for an operational environment. But the effects we want can be very different to, say, the effects that North Korea might want to have for its army, particularly when it comes to society. They might want to have a particular capability because it then carries prestige both abroad and domestically, and that can be a military effect. And really, that then leads into this one, which is flexibility. The ability and our platform to do is now they're increasingly flexible. The systems which they're integrated into are increasingly flexible. As I think there is a drive to make our people more flexible. And again, that comes into if we have to cut one aspect of our forces to do something else, can we then reskill or move across? Again, not again, I don't know which direction you want to dive into.
No, there absolutely is a lot there. You're right in terms of the shop window element of capability, and that is important to countries. That North Korea is a good example, you know, military parade in China for the 70th anniversary, absolutely shop window stuff. But that was, I mean, that was deterrence. That was Cold War. There was a review done at the staff course in Shrivenham that looked at, it was actually looking at the Falklands and the build-up to the Falklands. But when they were talking about equipment and they were talking about capability that we had ready to for those 30 days, it wasn't all about the shop window. You know, shop window was full of shiny stuff. There was bugger all in the stockroom. So I think that is... I think that's quite poor. I'm now struggling to remember some of the other.
So we had effects. We talked about the sort of the societal to impact. Yeah. I think we've done that, but we have the flexibility aspect of it.
Yeah.
I think that's key, isn't
Brilliant.
It?
Brilliant. Yeah. So yeah, and people. So I think those are key. So at the moment, if you speak to people, senior people in defence, we've got a lot of equipment. You know, you might not think it, but actually we are we've gone through quite a big period of reinvesting. And we are kit heavy at the moment. Are we neglecting the people? Well, quite possibly, when you consider the pool that we are fishing in, I do think that this matter will come to a head quite soon, that we've got to be smarter in how we manage our people. The one that does play into particularly the thesis and is the flexibility piece. And so again, one of the points that one of the interviewees made about how you position your capability so you can regenerate and so you can keep that seed corn. So that is very relevant. But then making sure that those things that you do have to then build everything else around when you have to do the regeneration, that's going to be as flexible as possible. Goes back to the point we made about process will only get you so far. You've got to be smart enough to be able to look at the finite resource in terms of cash that's coming the military's way and say, how can I best deploy this to be able to do as many of those things? Again, when it comes to the decision making at that top level, sometimes it's thinking the unthinkable, but it's being prepared to explore avenues, approaches that traditionally we never have, that might just give you a bit of headroom to go and do that cyber thing that you wanted, whilst keeping the ability to still deploy tanks on the battlefield. You know, how can you get the maximum out of the resource that is going to come defence's way? And it's almost a mixture of having the military experience. The problem is that it takes you 30 years to generate 30 years of military experience. And in that time, most of us have become so indoctrinated, so set in our way, that I've got all of that experience and all of that understanding. And you can't defeat me in detail, because I've got 30 years behind me and you've been a politician for 13 months. And that is a tactic that the services use about, you know, bringing the detail in to win the argument. But if you can deploy that level of experience, but combine it with a freedom of thought, then you may well find that some of the real intractable problems that exist around defence today are not perhaps quite as difficult to solve as we thought they were.
We talked on some of the challenges in terms of translating strategy, but are there any things, once we know the direction of travel we want to take, in particular which strikes you, which impedes that progress?
So the one thing, I've got to be a little bit careful. So of all of those categories we talked about very quickly, past defence reviews, strategic context, politics and politicians, affordability, running the defence enterprise, that's the process bit, the single services. If you look at those and say, is there one of those that actually impacts every single one of the others? I think there is. And I think it's the single services. That construct, that approach, that way of working, that system of professions impacts everything else. And And in some cases, it's very obvious. Well, of course it impacts the running of the defence enterprise because all the people that are doing that, the decision makers, are from the service. It impacts past defence reviews because, guess what? They were doing it then too. It impacts the strategic context. That's slightly more tricky. But actually, if you look at the way that we develop our thinking around the strategic context, then military strategy absolutely plays into that. People try and say, oh yeah, politics and politicians doesn't impact that. But I would argue that it does. An example that I would give, again, another conversation, another interview. So if you looked at the influence that the Prime Minister and the Chancellor had on the 2015 Defence Review, it was significant. They'd done a 2010 review, they had 5 years in government, they knew how it worked. You know, they were playing a board game that they'd pretty much created themselves, because 2010 was the first SDSR that we'd had. But they were absolutely cutting into the tactical decision-making about military capability. But the point about the politicians is, where did they get their ideas from? George Osborne, for example, before he became the Chancellor, and if you look back through his sort of political career, how did he suddenly become a military expert? He didn't. And he's not. But people talk to him. Same with Cameron as the Prime Minister. So the Prime Minister has a military assistant, an OF5, so a colonel, a Navy captain, or a group captain. Well, the services fight tooth and nail for that post. Why? Because that post has got the ear of the Prime Minister. Where is he going to get his ideas from? It's about a Royal Naval officer talking to the Prime Minister about the importance of carriers. It's about a Royal Marine colonel, who, as it happened, was his MA for most of the time, talking about the importance of amphibiosity. And so the services are absolutely doing what they need to do to keep themselves relevant and current, just like doctors and lawyers, and making sure that there's still going to be a place for them in the future. This is just another way of doing it.
Well, actually, we've talked about the pressure group effect of the militaries. And of course, when it comes to budgets, it's very rare that you'll lose, say, the amphibious capability and the money that goes with it, but get some just a nice chunk of money to spend on something else. That money's gone, and the chances are you're never going to get your budget back up to that level. So there is this sort of built-in incentive to defend every capability as hard as possible. And also, we've talked about pressure effect, and it's sometimes slightly more indirect. You might have a retired, very senior officer leaning on an MP who they know, who then goes to speak to the Prime Minister. That's one of the things which helped preserve the sort of Seacorn capability for a maritime reconnaissance. There was a lot of influence put in to trying to make sure that was preserved.
And you're right. And those things, you know, those things matter. They matter to the services, and they invest a lot of time and effort in getting those right. What I'm not saying in the fact that the services input into all of those categories make it, if you like, the driving effect of that military capability. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm saying it's a thing.
You said, you know, it's very much identifying the issues involved in capabilities. But of course, with all theses, you have to point towards future research. So this is perhaps a good point to end on, is how do we measure success in translating military capabilities from strategy?
So that's interesting. So future research is an interesting point. And when you consider that defence now, in fact, Western military forces now talk about five domains. They talk now about maritime, land, air, space, and cyber. You could say, well, we've got five domains, we've got three services. And actually, is there a better way of brigading the capability to be able to service what is needed in those five domains, rather than having an army and a navy and an air force? And maybe when it comes to what's next, what is the future research, maybe that's it. Maybe trying to understand how we organise ourselves better to deal with how we see that capability being employed in the future. So I think that's, if you like, the research bit. In terms of the measures of success, so that is really difficult. How do you measure the success of an insurance policy and the fact that you can actually use elements of that policy to do small things when you need to? So whether that's deploying for foot and mouth disease, whether it's a humanitarian disaster, whether it's defence diplomacy, whatever. And a lot of people look at defence in that way, is ultimately you're spending the big bucks so that if the house falls down tomorrow, or I don't know, you know, you have a gas explosion and you lose everything, then the policy is going to rebuild your house. But actually, if a couple of tiles comes off the roof, you can use your policy to repair the tiles. And that's actually not a bad way of looking at it. But then how do you measure the effectiveness of that? Well, defence does that in a very blunt way at the moment. It identifies, in theory, from the strategy, from the strategic objectives, it flows in all the way down to the outputs that defence is required to deliver, what are called defence planning assumptions. And they, in broad brush, say this is what defence is supposed to be able to do. This type of operation for this length of duration, and then recuperate and go again and do this and this and this. And the measure of effectiveness at the moment is, can we achieve those planning assumptions? Now, the reality is that since we brought those planning assumptions in, we have time and again exceeded them. So, for example, the scale of operation in Afghanistan and in Iraq that we were doing simultaneously, we were established to do for no more than 6 months, and we did it for years. So the problem is that we are being assessed, if you like, and we're making capability decisions against a set of planning assumptions that then pretty much go out the window as soon as anybody wants to use the military. So if you speak to the operations staff up in town at the moment, they will tell you that we've got over 30 named operations that defence is supporting around the world. That far exceeds defence planning assumptions. Who knows? How many people in the street know that there are three CH-47s supporting the French in Mali? That's not a secret. I mean, I haven't just given away state secrets on air.
I don't know, I might have to burn this.
Yeah, I think we're good. But the point is, you could argue that measures of effectiveness are irrelevant, that part of the can-do attitude of the service plus the amorphous mass that this capability gives you equals whatever the political ambition of the party in power is. The way that we field military capability is hugely flexible, even though we've talked a little bit about flexibility, and it can be more flexible, but it is still very flexible. The vehicles that I had under command to provide a strategic line of communication support for an expeditionary air wing anywhere in the world were perfectly suited to supporting the residents of the towns in Gloucester that were underwater during the floods of 2007. And how do I know? Because it's exactly what they did. So that flexibility is built in. And also in the way that we go about our business. So with all due respect to the government department that was handling the foot and mouth crisis, they weren't trained to manage that situation. So what do? You bring in the military. You bring in a military headquarters that is trained to plan, to deliver an objective. That's what the military does. And part of the problem with that is that you then, when you put that can-do attitude together with the flexibility of the military capability that we field and we maintain, you end up with the potential product is far greater than the sum of those two parts.
There seems to be a danger of going off-piste here. There seems to be almost two tiers to this, Finn. There's the definite strategic direction which you're given at a particular date for the next however many years, and the definite capabilities you need to meet that. And then there's that broader debate about what we might have to do, which we're not really planning for, but which might come up, and the flexibility you then build in to possibly deal with what you might be asked for, which isn't necessarily conceived of happening today.
So I would suggest it's probably the other way around. I would suggest that the politician starts with the... Do you know, have you ever heard of Ian Gillan?
No, I can't say that.
Okay, so he was a 1970s rock star. And he was in a group called Deep Purple, you might have heard of. He actually sang the lyrics for Jesus Christ Superstar, believe it or not. Anyway, sorry, a bit of a rabbit hole. This might not make the fight then. But I went to see, when I was growing up, I was a bit of a heavy metal freak. And I went to see Ian Gillan, and it was great. It was so loud that I'm still deaf. But at one point, he turned to the sound engineer between whatever it was he was smashing out. He said, right, I want everything louder than everything else. And that is the political start point. And so when you talk about going back to the problems with strategy, one of the problems that people have with strategy is I don't want to get tied down. I want to be able to do everything. I want to be able to react to situations, and I just want enough clubs in the golf bag, whatever analogy you want to do, that when the problem comes up, I can reach in and I can pick up my 64-degree wedge, or I can pick up my driver and I can smash the blazers out of the problem, or I can finesse it onto the green because that's what I need to do. But the club's got to be there. So actually, I think there's an element of it the other way around. So the politician would probably not want to give any strategic direction. Just have the stuff that I need when I turn to you and say, give. And of course we go, yeah, it doesn't work like that. All right, so you're going to make me say something. Right, how about... And so it is a dialogue. It is a negotiation. And I can guarantee that if a politician could do away with defence planning assumptions, they would. You're constraining me. Just do what I want when I want. Well, hang on a minute. If you're giving me some money, I've got to put that money towards something that I can measure. This sounds like reverse engineering. It absolutely is. So I deliberately didn't speak to politicians because this was focused at the military level. But if you were to zero in on the politics of the front end of that process, I suspect that one of the things that you would come up with would be, if I didn't have to write a national security strategy and I didn't have to give strategic direction, I damn well wouldn't. I just want everything louder than everything else.
I think that's a nice point, and it's almost, you could have a separate thesis looking at the politics side of this, where the question wouldn't be how does strategy translate into military capability, but how does military capability translate into strategy? And it does seem to be this two-directional path. So I think it's been fascinating talking to you, Andy, and thank you very much for coming in.
My pleasure.